Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. Today's program features cassette tapes. Basically, everything on today's show originates on cassette tapes. Inspired by a tape that was sent to me by Philip Sanderson. This one is called Ice Yacht Pole of Cold, and the accompanying notes tell me, tucked away on Snatch 3, the last of the Snatch Tapes DIY compilations released in 1981, is a track by Ice Yacht called 0 Degrees North. An austere piece of drum loop and drone music, there was talk of a full tape having been recorded by the band, but no documentation of any further releases can be found. Rumour had it that members of Ice Yacht had embarked on an ill-fated trip to the North Pole, attempting to retrace a journey made by the Norwegian explorer Fridtjof Nansen in 1888. This story was given some credence when last year a polar research group uncovered a cassette tape in a vacuum-sealed case in the permafrost. The white tape was marked simply Ice Yacht Pole of Cold. After letting the tape thaw out, it was then baked in a temperature-controlled oven for 5 hours, and though some oxide had peeled away, the tape was playable, allowing the transfer of the recordings. Pole of Cold contains 6 tracks of analog electronics, seemingly mapping an Arctic exploration to the wilds of the coldest place on the planet, though exactly when and where they were recorded is unknown. Fragment Factory has now released 100 numbered replica copies of the tape, available from the HTTP Fragment Factory, etc. The tape was produced by Philip Sanderson, a Snatch Tapes recording for Fragment Factory. And this track is from side B of the cassette, and it's called Vostok Station Hallucinations. Thank you. Okay, well, those were two tracks, in fact. Two tracks by a tape produced by Philip Sanderson. Apparently, this cassette tape found somewhere on a trip to the North Pole. It's a good story, Philip. Thank you. It seems to date from 1981. Ice Yacht, Pole of Cold. So all of the tracks, in fact, well, we had the last two tracks, which Vostok Station Hallucinations and Whiteout Woman. In fact, all of the tracks, the track list is Pole of Cold, Racing the Arctic Shadow, Snow Drifter, Summer with the Snow Bees, Vostok Station Hallucinations and Whiteout Woman. That's a limited edition cassette tape. In fact, all the tracks on this week's show are on cassette. So coming up next is James Coleman box, and this was issued as an audio art tape in something like 1977 or 78, and again from the accompanying notes, on the 23rd of September 1926, Tunney won the world's heavyweight boxing championship when he beat Jack Dempsey. A year later, he was back in the ring again to defend his title, as it is technically referred to, and once again he beat Dempsey. At some instant during the intervening year, Tunney, it would appear, was both champ and non-champ simultaneously, passing, as it were, from one psycho-physical state to another. Indeed, it had been said by some that the return fight was called because Tunney was no longer the man he had been when he won over Dempsey the year previously. However, the billing for the return fight made no reference to any question of an identity change, and in fact made such propaganda of the point that the old Tunney and Dempsey were back and fighting again. Here, in brief flashes from a film documenting the historic 1927 fight, we can observe the results this identity ambiguity is having on the boxers. Tunney was running away. Gene landed a left to the jaw. Jack hooked him to the jaw and put a right to the body when on the ropes. Gene danced away. However, Jack, rushing, drove a right and left to the jaw, and Gene landed a light right and left to the head and body. Dempsey bored in and put left and right to the body just as the bell went. And that's from the Irish Independent, Dublin, 23rd of September 1927. So this is an audio arts cassette, and it includes an interview with James Coleman with the installation Box in Dublin 1977, edited by William Furlong. Just takes me a while to negotiate the cassette recorder. Seems to be it.
Okay. Right. 20th of August 1977, Municipal Gallery Rosk exhibition, Seamus Coleman installation. We're about to record a few minutes of the sound track from the cartridge of the film.
Oh. Gaps that you've put in seem to somehow be parallel to the gap between us and the screen and the original film and your reworking of it, and it somehow places it in a much more objective realm. You know, if the film was just continuously being shown, it would correspond to the films that we see constantly on television, the way we're used to looking at them. So one's forced to examine that and perceive the image in a different way.
Yeah.
The more one looks at it, the way in which the very stylized movement of boxes almost becomes a very remote medieval kind of dance.
Yes. That's true, and I think that's why I don't think you are conscious particularly of, for example, the violence in the actual part. You are conscious by the impact probably of the imagery has been very much associated with kind of the content, if to use that word, of the film. But yes, I think, you know, it does make a distance which seems to it gives that space particularly where I felt I could come in on it. It's a very closed thing, a film, this particular kind of thing. There's very little you can add to it, as it were, if I just projected it on the screen. Even, in effect, the regular commentaries that you do get with a boxing match or even a football match, if you're looking at it, you don't really need them, except you want name references, but in a boxing match even less so. So it also gave, it opened a space to somehow come in on it without taking over it.
When there's a sequence flashing there, the after image somehow extracts the tensions and the energy from the movement between the boxes, talking about optical or the physiological way in which the thing operates, and the gap between things and the way we tend to feed things into the gap. And when the gap comes into this sequence and the after image is seen, one tends to try and fill in the gap in one's own mind, making the after image move through space to fill up the gap, but in fact, when the next sequence comes on, it goes behind the after image.
Yes.
So it really is very extraordinary the way that side of it operates.
Yes, I did quite a number of tests on this, and I'm still working on it. The intervals and the length of the flash is very important for this effect, and indeed it does create particular tensions for the this kind of film. As I say, 1927, you get one frame with the arm straight out and the next frame with the arm straight in. It's very jerky. So you normally try to fill these in anyway, but at a normal running speed, they just appear very jerky, and it doesn't have that...
Yes, how long, in fact, are the actual image sequences in time?
Running at 24 frames per second, they vary from a series of four frames to one. The intervals from 2 seconds to half a second, mostly around the 2 seconds. I don't know what you think of the effect of constructing the room to be as intimate and as isolated with the kind of the way the text was read, or the sound, the audio. It's meant to be fairly, well, I won't say claustrophobic, but anyway, create a tension on the space and the imagery.
So, in fact, you've also determined that the space we're seeing the film in, you can't stand up in it, that one has to physically adjust to the space and crouch down in it. It's about, sort of, what, 4'6" high?
That's right. Yeah.
In fact, is that the usual way in which you present film as installation, or to be seen in a particular context?
This is something which I tried to explain to people, that while this is on film, I never think of what I'm doing as films, or even within the context of experimental film, which is a very broad terminology. I never feel that my work really fits in. It's on Super 8 film. I'm very, still very conscious of the situation, and as such, the most, you know, normal way of describing them really are our installations. It really is a question of the direction you approach the... I'm not approaching it from a film angle at all.
You're using one ingredient of film, which happens to be, you know, Super 8 film and the process of projection, but, I mean, the feeling I get from this piece is not that I'm actually watching a film, but I'm watching... I'm being exposed, if you like, to a series of images that have very fragmented movement within them. But, you know, things like the sort of narrative development or continuous projection and so on aren't present, so that the references don't go back into film.
Yeah. What you said there, which I find I've been thinking of, and I find interesting what you said, was that due to the length of it, I think it's about 30 feet long, this kind of long tubular box, that you get the impression that the images sort of come up and go back again. I don't think I consciously thought of that, but now that you mentioned it, it does sort of create something like that.
And why I suppose the environment, you know, again takes it away from being referred to film. I mean, the way in which you've constructed the space where one has to sit in this position, and, you know, the images do kind of jump back and forth, which again is another, use of this kind of gap that is in the sequence, you know, the gap, the physical gap of 30 feet between the screen and...
I have done a number of works not using the images at all, but simply the physical space from which the viewer was listening to the recording. One of those was in the Ulster Museum, in fact, where I, on a long corridor, I made two recordings which could be heard by putting on earphones, which were directing the spectator's attention to a visual configuration outside the museum space, seen from two different points of view. And the idea was to relate the spectator's present perceptual images of that space of the it was a balcony, in effect, on the far courtyard, to relate his present images to the ones he had previously seen, if he had already heard the other recording at the other end of the corridor, or if he hadn't, and this his present viewing was the first one, he would then be related to his anticipated viewing or his future viewing. This wasn't as difficult as it might sound, because if I asked you, in fact, to try and draw the projector seen from approximately that position there, you would probably have a fairly good shot at what it would look like.
Yes, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. Today's programme is constituted of and with cassettes. They're all cassette recordings. And this is now halfway through James Coleman Box, which was edited by William Furlong, which includes the interview with James Coleman at the installation Box in Dublin in 1977. So if I now turn the cassette over, I think it continues for possibly another 10 minutes on the other side.
In a time context, I think this probably is one of the more continuous interests that might be noticeable in what I do.
In the installation that you just described, you were using images that were familiar to visitors to the exhibition. But taking them away from their context on film or on slide and readjusting the way in which they're seen and the frequency with which they're seen.
Well, yes. I eliminated the adding of images. I just, in the recording, I tried to just... direct the spectator's attention to what was already there. I didn't add any images. I only added the text which made relationships between spaces. And this is what we were saying earlier. It was essential to fix spatial points and relate them to one another. But without really any particular interest in the spatial problem. Yes, thank you very much. Thank you. Simply as a technique to... and a realization that, in effect, you do form your opinions from very much a point in space as well.
So, I mean, this is a theme that sort of constantly has occupied you in a lot of your work.
Yes.
The way in which spaces, I suppose, are perceived or images are perceived and taken for granted and yet contain layers that aren't seen.
There is also the aspect in this work of the content of the audio. It's something fairly new for me to realize the strength which you can be conveying, even in what appears to be very anonymous sounds and words. And I try to direct these more than probably I normally do, even the meanings of what I'm doing in a much wider context. I don't know how well that will come over. But it is sort of a conscious effort on my part to do that.
Yeah. I think one of the things that occurs to me listening to the soundtrack and hearing or seeing the images is this process we all have of trying to sort of form patterns of and organize the visual data that's presented to us, or the data generally. And if something doesn't fit in, one desperately tries to make it fit in, and in a sense there's a kind of a building or a constructing process going on in one's mind in trying to link the sound track, if you like, in some way or other to the visuals. And it doesn't, I mean, one can't relate it directly, obviously, but one, you know, looks for ways of linking the two together.
Did you read the description which we just pinned up there on the box? It just says that the match is between Dempsey and Tunney in 1927, and was a return fight, in effect, for Tunney, who had won in 1926, the year previously. This sort of point of departure is part of my way of working. What I thought amusing about it was that if Dempsey had won in 1926, that a year later it was necessary for him to reconquer his title. So it really meant that at some point between 1926 and 1927 he wasn't a champ anymore. I then sort of thought, well, it's really very funny, because what we're looking at in the fight is Tunney's reaction to this kind of ambiguity. I mean, is he champ? Is he not champ? Each blow seems to have a particular meaning in relationship to his position up there. And indeed, the same kind of psychological state would exist for Dempsey. And of course, what is strange, of course, is that in any of the billing for the fight, all the references were, in fact, to the old Tunney back again, and the old Dempsey. This question, really, of identity is something which interests me a lot. And I think with regards to identity, human identity, it's something new and something which I find quite interesting. Like when I was going over to London the other night, I was going on a student ticket, and the train inspector made me get out my ID card. So when I did, he said, "Oh, that's not you." I said, "Why?" He said, "You have a beard, and there's no beard on that." I was just wondering again, like, How long had my beard to be before it was no longer me? It's obviously a very normal practice, because the passport people will even make you at some point change your photograph, because it's no longer you. What really interests me in approaching this question also was this relationship between physical identity and personal identity. As an extreme, I suppose, strange questions would be, supposing you transplanted a man's brain entirely, someone put your brain into another body, or you got someone else's brain, how much of you would be the same? It's a kind of on-the-edge, borderline thing. It's a kind of a zone which was, in fact, one of the starting points for this work, and a lot of the areas too.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. It's also perhaps to do with the way in which we perceive others, strangers, and if we don't know them, we begin to kind of build up models of what we think they are and what we think their attitudes are and behaviours are. Mm. But then if we get to know them, those perceptions can often be very wrong. Mm. So one has to go through this remodelling, this readjustment process.
I think it's... you know, if I find myself that... I've noticed that a lot boils down to, you know, we were talking about our point in space, but I think it's really the old question of space-time, but I wouldn't like to limit it within that kind of sort of hackneyed phraseology. What I feel is you know, what makes us arrive at our ideas about things. Like you said, it's a continual kind of thing, and any opinions we have of anybody is going to be so dependent on these things that it makes it all like a non-question, and it's really very amusing.
Yeah. Well, there we go. That was James Coleman being interviewed by William Furlong in 1977 for the Audio Arts cassette James Coleman Box. Today's programme is all cassettes, all cassette recordings. We'll leave the nice tape hiss to carry on in the background. The next one is something called Radio Archival Oddities, 90 Minutes of Unusual Broadcasting, which was, again, only issued on cassette by WFMU, in fact, the New York radio station. And there's all sorts of oddities on here. I'm just going to play a brief extract while I sort of line up the next cassette. There's a sort of section called the mid to late 60s, which includes various ads by quite unlikely people, including Jefferson Airplane, who did an advert for White Levi's, and apparently Cream, who did something for Falstaff the Thirst Slaker, which apparently sounds as close as possible to Sunshine of Your Love without actually being the same song.
Now, Jefferson Airplane.
Right now, with your White Levi's. White Levi's come in black, flashing bravo blue. I love you. Right now, with your White Levi's. Right now, with some cactus in it, blue and white, crashing Loden. Right now with some White Levi's.
Now, Jefferson Airplane.
Duck. I can't wear white Levi's. You are probably human. You have all the luck.
Goes Andy Warhol's Plastic Inevitable show at the Trip starting tonight. You'll flip at the Velvet Underground and Nico, the Incredible Light Show, and Andy's fabulous Underground Movies. Better not miss it, baby.
Slide with me now down that purple shaft into the deep.
Yeah, okay. Well, those are three brief tracks from Radio Archival Oddities. The Jefferson Airplane one, apparently the only jeans commercial ever to employ backwards masking. Thank goodness it didn't fall into the wrong hands, they say, circa 1968. And there was the unmistakable sound of Jack Bruce and Cream singing about beer. Okay. The next cassette is a bit of an oddity. It's one that I just sort of had for decades and dug it out. It's in a sort of handmade cardboard case, which is in the shape of a bird with all this sort of handwritten stuff on it. I'm just going to play one track from this, which is called Because I Love You The Way You Look Tonight. And the lineup. Surprisingly to me, is cello David Fitzgerald, double bass John Edwards, and soprano saxophone Stephen Blake. And this was the Pointy Birds at the time.
Sky blue.
No, that's the wrong cassette. Where are we? Must be tape one.
Thank you.
So that's a cassette release by the Pointy Birds, dating from 1987. What have we got next? Okay, next is another great rarity. This is an edition of 25 copies only, released in 1996. And this is Leicester group Volcano the Bear. And this was their first ever release, also only on cassette. Now, let's hope I can get this one. Should be this one.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, sort of cassette special. This programme repeats on Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. That track was Volcano the Bear from their first release, an edition of 25 copies only on cassette. And we'll go out with a cassette recording of Paul Bowles' Baptism of Solitude. Baptism of Solitude, the first release from Bill Laswell's Meta label, is a rare recording of Paul Bowles reading passages from his greatest works, The Sheltering Sky, Let It Come Down, The Spider's House, Up Above the World, etc. And this is track one on the cassette, Up Above the World.
At some point in the night, she had a dream. Or was it possible that she was partially awake and was only remembering a dream? She was alone among the rocks on a dark coast beside the sea. The water surged upward and fell back languidly. And in the distance, she heard surf breaking slowly on a sandy shore. It was comforting to be this close to the surface of the ocean and gaze at the intimate nocturnal details of its swelling and ebbing. And as she listened to the faraway breakers rolling up onto the beach, she became aware of another sound, entwined with the intermittent crash of waves, a vast horizontal whisper across the bosom of the sea, carrying an ever-repeated phrase, regular as a lighthouse flashing. Dawn will be breaking soon. She listened a long time. Again and again, the scarcely audible words were whispered across the moving water. A great weight was being lifted slowly from her. Little by little, her happiness became more complete, and she awoke. The head is where the cricket sings. The cheeks are what the teeth will bite. The lake is where the lover flings the other in the dead of night. The lips are where the blood goes in. The eyes are what the fingers claw. Knowing now what might have been, will the lips tell what the eyes saw? Immediately, when you arrive in the Sahara, for the first or the tenth time, you notice the stillness. An incredible, absolute silence prevails outside the towns and within. Even in busy places like the markets, there's a hushed quality in the air, as if the quiet were a conscious force, which, resenting the intrusion of sound, minimizes and disperses sound straightway. Then there is the sky, compared to which all other skies seem faint-hearted efforts. Solid and luminous, it is always the focal point of the land.